السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته شيخنا، أحسن الله إليك.
آمين. أبو أمير how are you?
نعم الحمد لله.
We are 10 minutes late.
نعم yes. We are very sorry about that.
Connection issues. I've been trying to connect from the dot of time.
نعم سمع we didn't have subscriptions, we had to subscribe again.
Okay. How are you? Can we go on now?
Alhamdulillah.
إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا وسيئات أعمالنا. من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له. أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. أبوك على الأدب المفرد. We have gotten to hadith number 400 from it. We got to hadith number 400 from our book Al-Adab Al-Mufrad, and we thought that we should make today and tomorrow based of lessons, based of going back to revise the lessons. If we have questions and issues requiring clarifications, then we should talk about them and seek to find answers to them. So we have set aside today and tomorrow, inshallah, for the days of questions. We have set aside today and tomorrow for our question and answer series, inshallah. And then in the coming week, inshallah, we will be able to continue from hadith 401. But the point we are upon in the chapter that we have read in the recent weeks are about the Muslims being together and avoiding to disconnect from themselves. And when they have to disconnect, when the Muslims have to show disavowal for a Muslim with a particular negative behavior, how do they disconnect? What are the rulings of the Sharia that are connected to disconnecting from a Muslim? What are the rulings of the Sharia? That are related to these issues that we were upon before today, issues of Muslims. Being together, the Messenger said, "Alu wa sadu wala adabaru wa kunu ibadallahi ikhwana wala yahillu li muslimin an yahjura akhahu fawqa thalath layalin." These are the issues we're talking about. La tabaghadu, do not hate yourselves. Wala tahasadu, do not envy yourselves. Wala tadabaru, do not turn your backs against yourselves. وَكُونُوا عِبَادَ اللَّهِ إِخْوَانًا وَكُونُوا عِبَادَ اللَّهِ. All of you should be servants of Allah. إِخْوَانًا, you should be brothers. وَلَا يَحِلُّ لِمُسْلِمٍ أَنْ يَهْجُرَ أَخَاهُ فَوْقَ ثَلَاثِ لَيَالٍ. It is not lawful for a Muslim to disconnect from his brother for above 3 days. These were the issues that we were upon. And in one of the hadith, he said, alayhi salatu wassalam, وَخَيْرُهُمَا الَّذِي يَبْدَأُ بِالسَّلَامِ. And the best of them is the one who starts with the greeting of assalamu alaykum. So these were the issues that we are upon. So if we have questions, if we have clarifications, whether on these issues specifically or on other related, and try to Abu Amr. Abu Amr, Bismillah.
Naam, Shaykhana, sorry for. Hello?
No problem. I'm here listening.
Okay.
Just keep doing the question.
My network is a bit. Hello?
I can hear you, Abu Amr.
Naam. The first question here reads, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Is making only taslim to a Muslim neighbor without talking to her also a form of disconnection?
Well, yes, we have said disconnection have various forms. Disconnection has various forms. And from the biggest of them are those that include not saying salam to the individual. If you don't say more than can see, it can still be from the aspects of disconnection. If we go back to the hadith of Ka'b ibn Malik, one of the things that he was saying was that the people were even commanded not to say taslim to us. It means if the disconnection was just about, oh, don't trade with him, trade boycott, that's the disconnection too. If it is about, oh, a man not sleeping on the bed of his wife, that's some disconnection too. Yes, he will greet her, but he will not sleep on his bed. That's disconnection too. And we remember in the hadith of Aisha, with the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he told her, he knows when she becomes anointed. When she's anointed, she says, wa rabbil ka'ba ku. But when he's happy, he says what? Naam, wa rabbi Muhammad. If Aisha was glad, she will say, wa rabbi Muhammad. If she wanted to make an affirmation, she will say, Rabbi Muhammad. But if she was angry, she will say, wa Rabbi al-Ka'ba. So the Messenger, alayhi salatu wasalam, took that to mean a disconnection from mentioning his name. We are coming back to that hadith in this book, Al-Adab al-Mufrad. So it can even be a disconnection from, yes, you speak, you talk, but there's a nice, lovely way a man talks to his wife, right? Or a woman talks to her husband. But then that one becomes cut off. If you used to call him sweet Abu, he used to call you Apul Umu. When there is anger or disagreement, he just says Umu Abdallah. That disconnection from saying sweet Umu and you're saying Apul Abu itself is a sort of a disconnection, as we will understand from that statement of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, that when Aisha was glad, she would say wa Rabbi Muhammad. When she was not glad, she would say wa Rabbi al-Ka'ba. So that's leaving aside her, leaving aside his name itself, was counted from the aspects of disconnection. So even when you say taslim to someone, but your relationship, which was cordial, has stopped to become cordial, that's also from the aspects of disconnection. Now, if the source, if the reason for the disconnection is personal, if the reason for the disconnection is personal, then it shouldn't be for more than 3 days. If the reason for the disconnection is personal, then the disconnection should not be for more than 3 days. But if the source of disconnection is religious, perhaps that person became a kafir, then you thought that it was appropriate to disconnect from him or from her, as the case may be. Perhaps that person has became fraudulent. He became announced. He was fraudulent, or she was fraudulent. And the fraud became something that everybody knew about. And she or he was not becoming remorseful about it. You can disconnect. You see now, you can disconnect And that disconnection can be for more than 3 days. Or the person has a very, very bad character. You fear that this bad character can begin to affect you or your children or your family. You can disconnect and make it become a disconnection of Salaamu Alaikum. After Salaamu Alaikum, no further interactions. So if the disconnection is for the reasons of the read or of the deen, if it is for the reasons of the deen, it is completely about the religion. It can be for more than 3 days. Or the if it's someone you have power over, like your staff, like your wife, like your children, and they become sinful, or they do something that was grossly inappropriate and condemnable, then you can disconnect from them. As a man can disconnect from his wife when he has ila over her. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam disconnected from his wife. Radiallahu anhum, his wife 22nd. And we can see from the last hadith of Aisha that we had, she also disconnected from Abdullah ibn Zubayr when he made that statement that was very offensive to her. She disconnected from him, and it was for more than 3 days. I hope that this explanation will be clear, and it will clarify all other issues around that matter, inshallah. So disconnection can be, yes, you say taslim to that person, but you are still disconnected from him. But if the disconnection was for other reasons, like the reasons of Sharia, as we have mentioned, it can be for more than 3 days. If it was for about personal matters, it shouldn't be for more than 3 days for you to celebrate your anger and your displeasure. I hope that is clear, by Yusuf.
Assalamu alaikum. Naam.
Naam.
Abba Amina is taking it from me. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Bismillah.
Naam. The next question, sir, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum. Please, how do you maintain ties with a Muslim sibling which has vowed to fight you over our parents' inheritance, and they have taken the rest of us to the court, insults every one of the other siblings, even though they are the youngest, and vowed that they would rather have the inheritance destroyed than have us settle amicably?
This matter by principle. In the last explanation that we gave, we have discussed it by principle in the last matter that we gave. If you have disagreements that are connected to the religion, it means that in your own case now, you have to investigate what is actually the problem. Some relatives can say, let us share the inheritance according to the tradition. Some can say, let us share the inheritance according to Islam. This can be a means of a problem. And then some people reject education. Some relatives, even though they claim to have been Muslims, they reject education. No matter how patient you want to be, they reject all sorts of education. I think the matter, if it requires now to go to the courts, then let it go to the courts. If the matter would not be resolved upon mutual consultation, some relatives will say, let us distribute it by tradition, traditional religion, as if they are kuffar. And that is prohibited in Islam. It is prohibited in Islam to distribute inheritance upon the way of mushrikun. Yorubas, we call it idigi. This idigi is kufur, is shirk, and Allah has prohibited us from giving judgments and rulings and living our lives upon the ways of the people of shirk. Yet you will find Muslims insisting that is the approach to inheritance sharing that they would accept. And Allah said, لم ترى إلا الذين يزعمون أنهم آمنوا بالله. Do you not see those people who claim to say they say they believe in Allah? They want to seek judgments and seek rulings from things people who worship besides Allah. وَقَدْ أُمِرُوا أَنْ يَكْفُرُوا بِهِ. And they have been commanded to disbelieve in those things, distribute it upon traditions. So if they insist that they will distribute it upon tradition, then you go to court. The person who died was a Muslim. The children are all Muslims. So why the insistence? You can go to court. Whether the court is a secular court or the court is a Sharia-based court, but we give preference in this case to a Sharia-based court. Now, there can be a question from this. If you say that we cannot distribute it upon kufur courts, traditional courts, why should we take that education to a secular court? The ulama have clarified that we can take a case to a secular court if the ruling is the ruling, that particular ruling, the law in that secular court is the ruling of Islam. And we know that in secular courts today, what they rule for and pay attention to is the religion of the person who has passed away. If he was a Muslim, he lived his life as a Muslim, and he died upon Islam, the court can rule in favor of the Muslims that the Muslim law of inheritance should be employed. So for that case, they are not taking and seeking ruling from kufr. They are rather even seeking the ruling that supports the ruling of Islam. So it means that what really matters is the ruling. If the ruling is the ruling of Islam, then it should be taken from those courts. So you can seek redress in a secular court, even though the Sharia court is preferred here. What do you want there? You want a ruling that the remnants, what the estate of a person who passed away as a Muslim and has Muslim children should be distributed according to the rulings of Islam. So, and then the law will take its full. Every person in the family will take their share according to the rulings of the court. I think that will relate, resolve that kind of an issue. But in the meantime, the advice that I can give is that be patient and don't pay back evil with evil. The worst of what you can do, or the best of what you can do, is to avoid a scenario where you'll have to exchange words and abuse and insults. Avoid whatever will bring an exchange of insults and abuse and curses amongst yourself. I think that's a better thing to do while you seek redress in court about how the inheritance will be distributed. This is the advice that I can give now, given the information that we have and the span of time that we have. If you bring elders in your community who are Muslims and who know about Islam, if you bring them into the issue, they can also help resolve the disagreement in the family. I hope that is clear, Aba Amina.
نعم شيخنا جزاكم الله خيرا.
سيدي أكتر.
أنا كويشن سام.
نعم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. جزاك الله شيخنا. Can someone perform salat after ghusl, whereby he didn't perform wudu during the ghusl?
Yes, if someone had performed the ghusl and has performed it properly, he can also observe salat with the ghusl. You can also observe salat with the ghusl. Many of the scholars have mentioned this, the permissibility of observing salat with the ghusl, because the ghusl includes the wudu, because the ghusl itself includes the wudu. Even if you did not make a wudu inside that ghusl, the ruling of wudu in a ghusl is mustahab. The ruling of wudu, if you are making a ghusl, is that wudu is mustahab. the rukun of the pillars of the ghusl are two. The ghusl itself has two pillars, two things. If any one of them is absent, then the ghusl is null and void. The ghusl has two rukuns, ruknan. If any one of them is absent, then that ghusl is invalid. The first one is an-niyyah. You must have the intention that you want to purify yourself, whether from sexual impurity or from menstrual impurity or from nifas, impurity from childbirth, and or that you want to come into Islam. These are circumstances that make a person, obligates a person to have a ghusl. So when a person wants to now make a ghusl, he has to, or she, or you want to even make the ghusl of ihram, all these conditions requiring ghusl, you must have an intention that you want to make a ghusl that will bring you into the condition of a purity. This is number one. The second rukun of ghusl is that isti'abul ma, water must touch the entirety of your body. If you are making ghusl, you must have an intention that you want to make ghusl. And secondly, water must touch all parts of your body. All parts of your body must be touched by water. So it means if a person wants to make ghusl, he can just pour the entirety of the water, ensuring that the water touches the entirety of the body, or go under a shower, turn on the shower, and make sure water goes all over the body. Or fly deep into a river and just come out of the river. Water has touched all parts of your body, then you have made a ghusl. Now, to make a perfect ghusl that has more rewards than this ghusl that we have mentioned, you have to have that intention first. And then you start by washing the affected areas. If it is a ghusl of menstruation, you wash all the required things, that areas that you should wash. Likewise, if it is something about sexual impurity, you wash all the aspects that are affected. Then you wash your hands after that. After washing the affected area, you wash your hand. In fact, it is from the sunnah, if you can employ either soap or sand or any other thing to wash the hand properly, so that if you have any dirt sticking to your hand after you had used your hand to wash, this dirt will be washed off. It is from the sunnah of ghusl to wash the hands, whether with soap or using sand, after we wash the affected areas. Then after that, you make wudu. Normal wudu that you make wudu. So wudu is from the mandubat, from the sunnah of al-ghusl. When you now finish the wudu, if you like, you can wash the leg when you make that wudu. And if you like, you can wait and wash the leg at the end of everything after you pour the water upon the entirety of your body. They are both established from the hadith from the wives of the Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam in the Sahih of Imam Muslim. So if you make that wudu, you can wash your feet, or you can postpone washing the feet till the end of the ghusl itself. So after making the wudu, the normal wudu, then you start with the head. When you wash the head, you start with the right parts, the right sides of the head. Those are the parts that you start with. Then the left side. When you make ghusl and wash the body, starting with the right sides, and then the left sides, is also from the sunan of al-ghusl. So you wash them, you be sure that they have water all over them. Then you come down to the neck, then the chest area, the right side, and then the left side. Then you go downwards, the right side, then the left side. Then your feet, the right side, and then the left side. At the end of it, you now wash your feet, the right side, and then the left one. This is the end of al-ghusl. So you see, the wudu itself is from the sunan of al-ghusl. Otherwise, the two major things major elements we must find in your ghusl is that you must have an intention that you want to come into purification. That is what makes that ghusl different from your normal daily routine bath. Intention makes it different because innamal a'mal binniyat. So you have that intention. And the intention is not something you come and start saying in the bathroom where you want to have the bath. Allahumma inni nawaitu an aghsila. La. You're having it in mind that you now want to have a ghusl to come into the state of purity itself is sufficient for you as the intention for that action. Then the next thing is that pour water on the entirety of your body. So I hope that the question is clear, because in ghusl, water goes around the entirety of the body, and that would have covered all the parts of the wudu that we are commanded to clean when we make wudu. So when you come out from a ghusl, then you can make everything for which you can make a wudu, like salat. You can observe salat after ghusl without making another wudu. I hope that it is clear, inshallah.
Naam, Shaykh, I'm very clear. Jazakumullah khair. Hasanallahu ilayk.
Ameen.
I have another question, Shaykh. This question goes like this. Please, I need an explanation on who can do fidya, whom we can do it for, and how we can do it, and when we should do it.
I hope that this matter should be put to rest. Sometimes we ask a question, we ask it repeatedly. Last year, we had almost two or three classes where we were explaining the fidya, explaining the matters of the fidya. So we don't have to bring it again and again and again. Although I knew that it would come up in the matters when we remind ourselves about the rulings of Ramadan. But now that it has come, then perhaps we should mention, no matter how brief, about it, because we are still coming back to discuss Ramadan and preparation for Ramadan. And one of the preparations for Ramadan is to prepare for with the rulings of Ramadan. So that's why we will address the matter. It's not out of place still, even though we should avoid repeating questions that have been elaborated upon in previous classes. And perhaps maybe the person is new in the class. But in any case, fidya is what you do providing food. وَعَلَى الَّذِينَ يُطِيقُونَهُ فِدْيَةٌ طَعَامُ مِسْكِينَ وَعَلَى الَّذِينَ يُطِيقُونَهُ. The Quran said, those who find it a burden, who find it difficult to fast, فَعَلَيْهِمْ فِدْيَةٌ. These people have a duty to make a fidya. So what is fidya? Allah said it, to'amu miskin. You see now, the Quran itself explains what fidya is. Fidya is, it'amu miskin, providing food to a person who is poor or needy. Ramadan has come. The person is not able to whether make iftar, is not able to make sahur. When you provide that person food, that you're providing him food is called what? Fidya. But who is it who should make fidya? The Quran explains again. Alladhina yutiqunahu. Those who find it a burden to fast. It is burdensome for them to fast. So the question is, who are these people that find it a problem, a burden to fast? These are the pregnant women. It is a burden for her to fast. She can't fast. Why? She's pregnant. The other group of persons are those women who are breastfeeding. It's difficult for her to fast while she's breastfeeding the child. This is why some of the scholars say, if it does not bring a burden to her, then she should breastfeed the child and she should still fast. Because this is the basic rule. those who find fasting hard, they find fasting burdensome. So from them are the women who are pregnant. And that's why some still say, if she's pregnant and she's still able to fast, then she should fast. Why? The fast is not a burden to her. So she does not need a relief from fasting. So if the fasting is burdensome for her, like a pregnant woman, like a woman who is breastfeeding, like an elderly person, an elderly woman, or an elderly man, very aged, they can't fast. Why? Because they need to eat regularly, and fasting will become a burden to them. Don't forget, PDA is for Allazina yutikuna siyam, those who find it hard to make fasting, then they have to make fidya. So we have about four persons we have mentioned: the pregnant woman, the woman who is breastfeeding, an old man, or an old woman, or a person who falls into an illness that is continuous. We are not looking forward to the illness ending this year, 3 months' time, such that we can say, okay, after Ramadan, then she should pay back that fasting. That illness is continuous, and she has to be on drugs, or he has to be on drugs, he has to be upon monitoring, and so on and so forth, for the rest of life, or for a long time, 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, that person is upon medication. Those who have this kind of condition, we beg Allah to grant them sound health and relieve them from the burdens of ill health, and make their inconvenience from ill health kafara for them in this world and in the hereafter. So if a person is in this kind of ill health, then for those periods that for which the fasting is prolonged, then she cannot fast, or he cannot fast. Such persons will have to make fidya because they find fasting burdensome. So we have counted a number of people. These are the people who are entitled to make fidya. And fidya is what? Ta'amu miskin. Miskin, don't forget. This is where I also have to warn people who collect money for fidya. These days now, you find women going about making flyers, bring money for fidya, bring money, and they don't know who to feed for fidya. Fidya is feeding poor people. Then they call their friends and relatives, they go to one masjid and begin to feed people. No, fidya is to feed people who are poor. If it is fidya you want to make, you have to take the responsibility. As you have taken the responsibility to collect money from people, you must also take the responsibility to look for poor people who are entitled to the fidya. Fidya is not provided to those who have the ability to feed in the month of Ramadan. Fidya is provided to people who are actually poor, needing to be provided food in the month of Ramadan. Then there is also a question. Is it sahur or iftar? Either of them. Either of them. If it is sahur, you can provide, you have provided. If it is iftar, that you can provide, then you have also provided him meal. Either of the meals. But the most burdensome meal poor people need is the iftar itself. That's why it's like the standard practice is iftar. Then what is the quantity of food? The quantity of food is the standard meal, the meal that is sufficient for the individual. There are some asar about the extent, the standard of meal. Like it was in the time of Abu Huraira radiallahu anhu, he gave a particular measure. But the text will show that yes, that was what he preferred radiallahu anhu. From what I can remember now, I don't think there are narrations from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, from what I remember now, that specifies the quantity of food to give. But we know that when we give food like this, it must be the standard meal that is sufficient for an adult. So this is what we give as fidya. So fidya is what you provide in lieu of every day of fasting. So instead of fasting, you have provided a fidya. And that's the reason why you do not come back to insist that whoever provides fidya should fast again, because that person has done badil. So why do you ask for the afsal again? The person has done the replacement. He has done an atonement. So why do you come back to say the person should repeat the fast again? So if you are qualified and suitable for fidya, such as a pregnant woman, such as the breastfeeding woman, such as the aged man, such as the aged woman, or such as those persons who have illnesses that the cure are not in sight, these people are due for fidya, and they are not due to pay back those fasts. Why? They have already atoned for those fasts with what? With the fidya. That's why the Quran says, وَعَلَى الَّذِينَ يُتِيكُونَهُ. As for those who find fasting in the month of Ramadan difficult and hard, burdensome, فَفِدِيَةٌ طَعَامُ مِسْكِينَ. Such persons should now make fidya by providing food to poor people. I hope that this will answer all the about 5 or 6 questions that Abu Amina asked in one. Abu Amina.
No. I don't know if you address the issue of when she should pay. Is it during or after the Ramadan?
Yes, it should be during Ramadan. Fidya is to provide the meals to those persons in the month of Ramadan. Allahu a'lam.
Naam, jazakumullahu khairan, shaykhana.
Ameen wa antum.
Naam, the next question, inshallah, bukuratullah, is it says, salamu alaykum, shaykh.
Abu Ameen.
Naam.
There's a question here related to something we had discussed, and I think it is beneficial if we mention it.
Naam, shaykhana.
The person said, can I just perform ghusl for no reason and pray with it? For instance, I find it very easy to end my bath with ghusl. Yes, it is permissible. Just like wudu. You can make wudu even though it's not that you want to observe salah. Just making wudu because it is worship. Making wudu is worship and it is praiseworthy. Don't forget that. That was the reason why the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he heard the footsteps of Bilal inside Al-Jannah in his dream. The Prophet had a dream. He heard the footsteps of Bilal in Al-Jannah. He was asking Bilal, what were you doing? He said, whenever my ablution got initiated, I made another ablution. And it was not for Salah, not necessarily for Salah. Even though if you make ablution, it is encouraged for you to make 2 units of prayer. There are 2 units, 2 rakats connected to what wudu. If you make wudu or ghusl, you can observe those 2 units of prayer. But even without observing any 2 units of prayer, making wudu itself is an act of what? Ibadah. So since it is ibadah, it is allowed for you to make it at any time with the intention of keeping pure. And then you get the rewards for being pure. For example, wudu. The Messenger alayhi salatu wasalam, he told us that after wudu, we make shahada. After that shahada, we do what? We say, subhanaka Allahumma bihamdik. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa ant. Astaghfiruka atubu ilayk. Anybody who does this, all his sins will be forgiven. All his sins. So the doors of the heavens will be open. Make dua. Whatever dua you make will be accepted. After wudu. So you want to make dua for something. You just make wudu. After the wudu, you begin to make dua. You begin to supplicate to Allah. Begging Allah for something. Why? You have done something that makes acceptance of dua to be facilitated for you. So ghusl and wudu are things that we can do at any point in time. They are open. When you do them, you get the rewards for them. And one of the evidences for that is the hadith of Bilal that we have mentioned. Bilal was not only making wudu because he wanted to pray or because he wanted to make nafila. No, he was making wudu just to keep pure and clean. And Allah likes that which is pure. Inna Allah tayyibun la yaqbalu illa tayyiba. Inna Allah jamilun. I hope that it is clear, Abu Amir, Abu Alina.
نعم فعلا جزاك الله
آمين. نعم أبا أمينة I can't hear you أبا أمينة.
السلام عليكم.
Yes I can hear you but faintly. Just go on. Hello? I can hear you again now. I can hear you again now if you hear me. So what I will do is to read some of the questions that I have. Till I can hear you.
Okay, Sheikh, can I go ahead? So if you can hear any question with you then.
Just go on. Just go on now. I can hear you now.
All right. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh.
Alaikum salam. Go on.
How do we teach our children sex education? Okay. How do we teach our children sex education on these days and age of ours, where sex education to children is being propagated?
These are issues about.
Did you get my question, Sheikh?
Yes. Abu Amina, I heard you.
All right, sir.
Well, no, these are questions that burden the mind a lot. These are questions, they bring a lot of worry to the mind. Just yesterday, I saw a video of a woman in the US or in the UK. She went to the school. Her children are pre-teens. That is, they have not reached teenage age. So she went to their school and she was looking at the books in the school library, and she was finding books where the relationship between a man and his wife are drawn, the pictures of drawings. In fact, she went to the sections of the nursery and the first primary school. Most of the diagrams in some of the books that were there were showing how a man has something to do with his wife and the likes of this in the Western world. So she removed those books and she went to the school admin, and it was a very, very hot discussion. She was annoyed. She was angry. She was a kafira, complaining that why you bring these kind of things to children at age 10, at age 7, 8, 9, 10. Age 7, 8, 9, 10. Less than 10. By telling a child about these kind of things. So I think that the matter is blown beyond what it is. We all were taught to be careful about our privacy. A one-year-old Muslim girl is careful. She wants to wear hijab. She knows that you can't raise her clothes up her. By intuition, I tell you, if you keep to the instructions on hijab in your house, by intuition, your children will know it. We all have homes. So everyone knows what goes on in his home. If women in your home keep to the instructions on hijab, they don't dress anyhow. Mothers don't wear. Some sisters, some umahat, I will not be sad. I will not be, it will not be strange to hear that some women will still be wearing bumpers, nika, inside their houses when they have children that are 13, 14 years old, boys, 11-year-old boys. You are wearing a nika in your house. You are killing your son already. Don't teach him any sex, anything. You yourself, you are killing your son if you can wear a short trouser inside your home. When you have boys or when you have girls, you are giving them lessons that are bad. Or that women who don't sit down properly, you teach your children bad lessons because your children too will not sit down properly. So a lot of matters lies with mothers and how they bring up the child. A girl, for example, will be brought up to close up herself. Hey, Fatima, sit well. Hey, Mariam, sit down properly. You don't need to start telling her, you know, if you don't sit down properly, this one is exposed, that one is... No. She takes it as a way of life to sit down, closing up herself. Hey, don't talk, don't do that. Don't expose yourself. You are, don't... from that is having children bath naked together. Some women, Yorubas have something they call oroju. Oroju ni o pa obirin mi. So that is laziness of a sort. You have three girls. One is age 6. The other is age 3. The other one is age 9. You bring them all to the bathroom together, all of them naked. You want to give them a bath. You are already destroying your children. So if you keep decency from a very young age, you teach your children to cover up themselves. You do it for them from age 1 to 2. Your boys understand somehow that they can't see anything from their younger sister who is 3-4 years, even 2 years. They can't see anything from her, from what women should keep normally. And she herself knows that I can't expose this part of myself to anybody. It will happen by intuition. You don't need to start a class. You don't need to start a class on jinsi. Yes, our own parents did not start classes, and we all knew we schooled in some of the worst places anybody could go to school in this country. So, and then there are young children that we are seeing with basic lessons of decency. Teach basic. When did sex education start? That now the whole world wants to take a craze about it. When did it start? It started when we all became adults, having children. We got married and began to have children before this matter started. You have to teach us. I said education. You have to. And some of the Muslims, we are crazy about what the Muslims become crazy about. When Muslims become crazy about something, some Muslims start thinking that we start looking for a place to fix it up in Islam. Bring up your home, bring up your children with decent behavior. You don't need to start a sex 101 class. No, just the way you relate to the children from the very first day, they understand basic things, no go areas. There are children, 1, 2, girls, age 2. He has, that's a visitor. Is the visitor a male? Yes. They run back into the house. There's an understanding that when they say it's a male visitor, we the girls must go away. Is this the girl that male teacher wants to open up her dress? And these are from the evils of, like, Sheikh Muhammad Sheikh Abdul Aziz ibn Abdullah ibn Baz was asked, is it lawful to allow men to teach young girls? Is it allowed to allow old women, to teach little children, boys? He said, no, don't allow women to teach young boys. Likewise, avoid it that those who teach your girls are men. If they are men, then they must strictly keep to the limits of the Sharia, if it is possible. To find women who will teach girls, let it be all women throughout. That's why I was looking at a video yesterday of a brother's school. This brother is a very, very conscious brother. And I saw the girls sitting together with the boys. You will say they are children, Abi. They don't understand anything, Abi. You will get the results when they get to primary 4. You will know that time by primary 4, primary 5, that they understand what you think that they can't understand. So separating them from childhood is very, very important. From the beginning, start separating them. The schools they go to, make it be separate. Don't take your children in a primary school to a mixed school. Don't take your children in primary school to a mixed school. Take them to singly girls school, primary, if they are girls. Singly girls boys school, if they are boys. And in that boys' school, let it be that it is men that will be teaching the boys. In the girls' school, let it be that it is girls, women, who will be teaching the girls. These are areas that our women should be busy with. Many of our women who are busy with selling bags and shoes now, they should be busy with being teachers. Many of them are graduates. You can be teachers. Set up singly girls' nursery and primary schools. Let it flow everywhere. Girls, Muhammad
nursery and primary school, girls, for girls alone, up to secondary school level. These things will help reduce all of these. It will be a situation where the girls can preserve their honor, they can preserve their chastity, they can preserve their shyness, not bringing them in front of men. I also saw a video of a Muslim school. The girls are in secondary school. They are running inside National Stadium. They said they wear hijab. You're already destroying them. You're exposing them. You are telling them not to be shy. And the male teachers were shouting, hey, how does a girl in senior secondary run? And the male teachers are shouting, videoing them. And you think that those girls have not lost shyness. They have lost shyness. You destroy the shyness. So the hype about sex education is beyond what it is. Bring up your children properly. Expose them appropriately. Expose them appropriately. Make them be in girls' situation in all the times. Make them be, a brother told me recently, I attended the marriage of the girl. The girl too is like a daughter to me. I attended her marriage. Her mahar was Kutubu as Sunan al-Arba, the four books of Sunan, Sunan Abi Dawud, because that girl had memorized Sahih al-Bukhari, and at that time she was almost finishing Sahih al-Muslim. So when she asked for mahar, the girl finished secondary school that time. This is just 2 years ago now. So when she asked for mahar, she asked for the four books of Sunan, Sunan Abi Dawud, Sunan Tirmidhi, Ibn Majah, and Sunan al-Nasa'i. That was her mahar. The scholar who connected the marriage, he was saying that he has not seen this kind of a marriage before. When what the wife asks for is books of hadith, then don't ask. She's not asking you for Sahih al-Bukhari. She's not asking for Sahih al-Muslim. Why? She had already learned those ones. Now the point here was that the father said to me that this girl, no man ever taught her a lesson. No man ever taught her anything. Everything she learned were from women. So if a girl is brought up like this, you don't need to start telling her this is how to relate, this is how not to relate with a man. No. Because you did not even expose her to a man. Now, if it is about women, even the women that you will expose her to will be upon a choice. Select women. The same thing for your boys. Don't expose your boys to female teachers. And the males that you will expose them to, let them be select. So that is why you as a Muslim male, father, you will not be able to send your children to non-Muslim schools, especially those ones that are private. Because every school, they have an agenda. Every school has an agenda. So if you send them to Christ the Lord Secondary School, yes, you are the one asking this question, how do you handle sex education? Because they have their own agenda. So you are the one who has to start running about. Don't ask whether your children know in the name of Jesus and all this when they pray in the morning. They say yes, they can tell you yes, we allow them to wear hijab. That is a bait to catch you and to catch your children and your family. So for the sake of Allah, Muslims, wake up. Our women, start doing it. It's a big, blessed job that you can do for this Ummah. What is it? 3-4 Muslim women come together. Instead of selling bags and shoes and doing corporate marketing on WhatsApp, come together, set up a primary school for Muslim girls in your area. Once we begin to do this, in fact, it can grow up into a secondary school, 4 of you. You take 20 students, for example. 4 Muslim women take 20 students. Divide the class into 2 of 10. 10 students here, 10 students here. If you can't teach them Quran, go and look for one of you. Deposit her in a madrasa for 1 year to learn Quran. And then bring her back to join the school. Let us start single girls, Muslim schools, primary, nursery, primary, secondary. Let us start it. Single girls, where those who will teach those girls are women or largely women. If we can't find women to teach some of the courses, we must also start the process of being able to get women who can teach those classes. These are things that the Ummah need people to volunteer. some of our allied Muslim men are usually crazy. All their problem is about having Muslim doctors, Muslim engineers. Where there are Muslim women who will teach women, they don't know that one. Many of our professors and doctors and allies, you will say, hey, there are no Muslim women to treat Muslim women. Are there Muslim women to teach Muslim women the religion of Allah? So you can volunteer your own daughter. Say, this is my own daughter. What you will learn is all about Islam, so that we can have women too who can be teachers, who can be ustazas, who can be advisors, who can be guides for women upon good knowledge. And you have to start that from the foundation. If you don't have that from the foundation, then don't start asking, start teaching about sex education, etc. Our own parents didn't teach us that. Many of us, anybody who is above 45 going to 50 now, we didn't have this kind of thing. And yet there was decency. Why? Where most of us were brought up upon decency. So let us be decent. The decency itself will involve a sense of decency in the children. You don't need to start asking your children, this is so, this is so, at age 4 and 5. You are destroying your children. May Allah protect us. You don't kill an ant with a hammer. You may end up injuring yourself. Abu Amina.
No, I'm sure now.
There is a question regarding children here. Let me take that question and then we can stop there today.
Okay, Shekhan.
Can a 7-year-old boy lead Salah if he has memorized enough parts of the Quran to lead and he knows how to pray? Yes. Even if it be a 5-year-old boy, as long as his Salat is decent and he knows the Quran properly, yes, he can do that. And that happened even during the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad, alayhi salatu wasalam. A 6-year-old boy led the whole, not just a mosque, the whole community. He was the only one who could lead Salah. In fact, in his own case, when his dress is to fall off his body. And the women will be telling the men at the front, please help us dress our imam correctly. Because he was the only one who had known enough of Quran to be able to lead the people Salah. And I think the story of how he learned the Quran, his father did not know anything from the Quran. His mother did not know anything from the Quran. Nobody in the community knew anything except him and some of his mates. But he surpassed all of them. How did he now learn the Quran? Let me say this story. The hadith occurs in Sahih al-Bukhari. When Muslims pass by, their community has a water, like a well or something. So the companions, radiallahu anhum, will stop by. They will take some water. They will take some rest. And then they continue their journey. When they did that, they read Quran amongst themselves. So as children who go to fetch water, if they hear something strange, what do you think they'll be doing? You want to learn it. Look at this man. He is reading something. He is listening to it. That was how those people began to learn Quran, those children. At that time, their own parents were still upon shirk. So when their community accepted Islam, who will be the teachers? Those children who used to see Muslims praying, reading Quran, and they used to sit with them. Those of us who grew up in largely non-Muslim communities, we know this. In the masjid where we prayed as children, many boys around who were non-Muslims, they could read Surah Al-Fatiha correctly. They could read Surah Al-Kawthar, Surah Al-Ikhlas correctly, and they are non-Muslims. In the Niger Delta, we can go back and find out. In the area where we lived, the children of non-Muslims could recite Surah Al-Fatiha. They could call the Adhan. They could, in fact, they could observe Salah because they see us observe Salah. So children learn a lot. That's why don't expose children to things that are not of Islam at their early age. If you put them in a community, in an environment where everything they'll be seeing is about Islam, they are most likely going to grow up upon Islam. But when you bar them in the name of looking for big school, big this, big that, you bring them in the community where they only mix with the children of the rich and the affluent in the society, your children will be like those children too. If your children now begin to behave like that, don't blame anybody. You took them there. You paid the millions for it, for your child to be as he or as she has grown up to become. May Allah protect us and grant us success. Abu Amina, we can stop here today, inshallah.
نعم شكرا لك جزاكم الله خيرا وأحسن الله إليك.
آمين وأنتم
في الله. إن شاء الله وكنتم
إن شاء الله. السلام عليكم.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته ومغفرته.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته يا شيخ أنا. يا شيخ أنا.
يا زلمة تردي.
شكرا لك.